Good afternoon. I'm Robert Gassaway, and it's my honor and pleasure to welcome you to this closing panel of the 2014 Lawyers Convention. Our topic today will be an important new book, Saving Congress from Itself, and we will hear from three distinguished panelists. First, the book's author, well known to many of you, former New York Senator James Buckley, who's had an extraordinary... I was just going to say an extraordinarily distinguished career in both the public and private sectors, including service in high office in all three branches of our federal government. So, Senator Buckley. We'll also hear next from Professor John Eastman. Professor Eastman, as many of you know, is a distinguished constitutional advocate and scholar. He holds a PhD from the Claremont Institute. He's written extensively on a number of topics, including most relevantly for today, the spending clause, and then we'll also here finally from Professor Michael Greva, whom many of you also know, another distinguished constitutional advocate despite not having a law degree and distinguished constitutional scholar, holds a PhD from Cornell and has written many, many books and articles, including most relevantly The Upside Down Constitution, published by Harvard University Press. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Senator Buckley, and I'll ask Jim to tell us why he wrote and published this book. Senator Buckley.
Thanks for the introduction, Rob. I wrote the book because in the last few years I've become aware of a congressional addiction that has resulted in extraordinary squandering of money while at the same time undermining the way we ought to be governing ourselves and have been governing ourselves. So, but unfortunately this addiction is somehow missed. I've been overlooked by professional students of how we govern ourselves. But I hope that by publishing this book, I will trigger a debate that will in due course cause Congress to indeed save itself, and having accomplished that, save the Republic. I want to begin first by thanking the Federalist Society for giving me this opportunity to describe my book's central thesis and the reasoning behind it. And I'm also delighted to share this panel with John Eastman and Michael Greve, who no doubt will expose the weaknesses in my analysis, but in the politest terms, I hope. In my book, I have the temerity to suggest that Congress abandon what has become its favorite preoccupation, namely the creation and exploitation of programs that distribute money to the states and local governments for purposes that lie outside Congress's authority. I have long known such programs existed because I routinely voted against them when I was in the Senate. But it was only recently that I became aware of how pervasive they have become and of the political reasons for their proliferation. My epiphany began a dozen years or so ago when on my retirement, I returned to Connecticut and subscribed to a nearby city's daily paper. I soon found it filled with reports of federal grants in support of an astonishing variety of local purposes. These included, for example, a $1.5 million grant of highway trust funds for the rehabilitation of a vandalized railroad station that had long since been converted to private non-transportation uses, an art center honoring Katharine Hepburn in her hometown of Saybrook, Connecticut, nearly $2 million to replace a one-lane bridge connecting two small communities about a dozen miles from my home, and a $500,000 grant to widen two sidewalks leading to a school. That last is my favorite example of congressional imagination. Those sidewalks are being widened courtesy of the Federal State Routes to School program, whose explicit purpose is to fight juvenile obesity by encouraging children to bike or walk to school. I'm not sure the parents of the children attending that school feel that that is the most cost-effective way of keeping their children slim, but no matter, you don't turn down Santa Claus, even if the money he distributes comes from the taxes you pay or from debt your children will have to repay. I also noticed the frequency with which these grants were announced by the congressmen representing the recipient communities. The fact is, securing federal grants has become today's favorite form of pork because it is free of the stigma of the old-fashioned kind in which a member of Congress secured federal funding for a local project that was utterly unrelated to any existing federal statute or policy. Today, bringing home the bacon consists of securing money that has already been appropriated. If it isn't spent in the congressman's constituency, it will be elsewhere. And that, I believe, explains the explosive growth of grants and aids programs from 132 at the outset of the Lyndon Johnson administration to the more than 1,100 that exist today. In 1970, those programs distributed $24 billion. This coming year, they will distribute almost $641 billion, which amounts to 1/6 of total federal spending, and all for purposes that are the exclusive business of the states. Because those grants come with the most detailed instructions, their total cost to the federal fisc includes not just the amounts distributed, but the expenses incurred in ensuring that the recipients comply with the federal rulebook. That additional oversight has been estimated to cost $1 for every 10 distributed, which would amount to about $64 billion during the coming year. The major cost to the federal government, however, may well be the diversion of congressional attention from the critical issues that only Congress can address. Studies confirm that its members spend heroic amounts of time on their work. Those studies also confirm that they spend a major portion of that time attending to constituent concerns that, unfortunately, tend to focus on matters that are appropriate for governors and mayors rather than on those of a congressman. Matters such as public housing, job training, and unfilled potholes. I mention that last because a recent senator from New York actually earned the nickname of Senator Pothole. The costs at the state level are far more diverse. The most immediate of these, of course, are also administrative, as officials sort through the cornucopia of available programs, prepare grants applications, enter into agreements with the relevant federal agencies over how the money is to be spent, and then ensure that the conditions are, in fact, complied with. But the costs to the states go far beyond the addition of extra layers of administration. Here are examples of just two of the six categories of state costs that I describe in my book, beginning with the distortion of state priorities. Programs that return the largest multiple of the dollars states themselves invest can prove irresistible. In a remarkable feat of grantsmanship, this past summer, Connecticut drew on six separate highway programs to secure 80.2% federal funding for a controversial $500 million 9.4-mile busway between two cities that, on completion, will save an estimated 13,400 commuters a dozen or so minutes a day. As the Hartford Courant observed when Washington approved the last of the six grants, Monday's infusion of $275 million made Governor Malloy's crucial support for the risky project awfully easy. It was then, only then, that the state felt justified in committing its $113 million share of the busway's cost. But that meant that that money would not be available to help repair what a contemporaneous Associated Press article described as 200 Connecticut bridges that were in danger of collapse on the failure of a single vital component, including 49 that are crossed by 1.8 million vehicles a day. But priorities be damned. State officials have proven unable to resist the seductive offer of four federal dollars for every one of their own. A category of costs that will escape most people is that of unfunded mandates. The grant of federal money can trigger a bewildering variety of collateral obligations, such as the Bacon-Davis Act's requirement that the equivalent of union wages be paid for all construction work involving the expenditure of any federal dollars, and this requirement can add up to 20% to the cost of particular projects. They can also be incredibly complex. Those associated with the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act require a mastery of 1,700 pages of regulations. Grants-related mandates exceed 1,000 in number, and in 2006, unfunded mandates were estimated to cost one Virginia county $283 million. Federal grants programs also undermine accountability and self-government. Because officials in states as varied as Alaska and Arizona and New York are required to comply with the same complex one-size-fits-all regulations devised by federal agency, they cannot be held responsible for the excessive costs and failures of the federally subsidized projects that they administer, even when the states pay most of their cost. And because those regulations are made by distant bureaucrats, frustrated citizens who are directly affected by them have lost the ability to decide how their own tax dollars are to be used. This litany of costs notwithstanding, advocates of federal grants argue they are warranted for two reasons. The first is that the federal government is able to attract far greater expertise than the states. That is no doubt true, but it begs the question as to whether academic prowess trumps the hands-on experience, common sense, and personal accountability on which the states used to rely. Compare the Centers for Disease Control's bungling of the Ebola crisis with New Jersey's simple policy of quarantining those exposed to the disease, an example that the Department of Defense has chosen to emulate. The advocate's second argument is that federal grants contribute money, redistribute money from the wealthier states to the poorer ones that enable the latter to maintain appropriate national standards in such vital areas as education. That is a seductive argument because the per capita income of the 10 poorest states is only 67.6% of that of the 10 richest. Variations in state costs of living, however, can muddy the analytical waters. To cite an extreme example, Mississippi's per capita income is 75% of Hawaii's, but its cost of living is only 55% of the latter's. I doubt, however, that anyone would suggest that Mississippians who inhabit our poorest state should send care packages to Hawaii, which is our 17th wealthiest. Redistribution is a weaker argument than it appears, but if redistribution is indeed a proper function of the federal government, there is a far better way to achieve that goal without imposing webs of detailed federal regulations on all the states, rich and poor alike. The federal government could simply provide the have-not states with block grants having the sole requirement that the recipients use the money for welfare or education or some other specific purpose. Under that approach, Washington would not be telling the states how to meet their own responsibilities. Now, Congress finds its authority to create those programs in a 1937 Supreme Court construction of the Constitution's spending clause, which empowers it to spend money, quote, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. The mischief lies in the words general welfare. Chief Justice John Roberts recently summarized that holding as enabling Congress, in pursuit of its understanding of the general welfare, to use federal funds to, and I quote, induce the states to adopt policies that the federal government itself could not impose. Thus, Congress is now licensed to dabble in areas in which it is forbidden to act by bribing the states to adopt Congress's approaches to problems that are the states' exclusive responsibility. But because grants programs deal with matters beyond Congress's constitutional authority, the court has made it plain that participation in them may not be coerced. That last has caused program advocates to assert that because states participate in them voluntarily, they cannot complain about the costs and conditions that flow from the grants. Experience, however, has demonstrated that congressional bribes are very, very hard to resist. Money from Washington is still regarded as free, and state officials are delighted to accept grants, strings and all, rather than having to justify the full cost of the projects they freely undertake with federal subsidies, or to raise the extra money that would have been required to cover them. What makes declining grants particularly difficult is the fact that if a state does not participate in the program, its share of the money that is derived in whole or in part from its own taxpayers, will go elsewhere. Richard Epstein and Mario Loyola have written an elegant article that concludes that federal grants are, in fact, inherently coercive. In saying that, I nevertheless recognize that 23 states have in fact refused to participate in Obamacare's expansion of Medicaid coverage, but that is the exception that proves the rule. Having experienced the very substantial collateral costs of their existing Medicaid coverage, those states have declined to compound them. There's only one way to resolve the problems that have resulted from Congress's addiction to these programs, and that is to terminate all of them. They must all go because none is free of the cost that I have described. If any exception is made, members of Congress will be encouraged to launch a new wave of grants on the assurance that theirs will be exempt from all the problems that have plagued the existing ones, and it would take another generation to prove them wrong. Because federal subsidies come and now constitute about 30% of state revenues, however, Congress cannot cut off the flow of funds overnight. I therefore suggest that it terminate the programs by converting all the grants the states and localities are currently relying on into single, no-strings-attached block grants, one for each state, that would be phased out over a period of half a dozen years. That would allow Congress and the states the time to adjust their respective tax codes to accommodate the successive reductions in the federal transfers. That, in sum, is my book's modest proposal, a reform that at one stroke would reduce federal expenditures by 1/6, rid Congress of a major distraction from its essential national responsibilities, and restore the conditions for a healthy federalism. This reform, of course, would be a great vigorously opposed by all those who have built their careers exploiting the programs, and by the many thousands who are now engaged in administering them. It is my hope, however, that newly elected members of Congress who have not as yet been contaminated by the prevailing congressional culture might study and then embrace the proposed reform, because in no other way could they achieve so broad a range of public benefits. As it happens, this is a particularly propitious time to seek a reform of the kind I propose. Recent headlines concerning incompetence and worse at the IRS, Veterans Administration, and other agencies have undermined the myth that Washington necessarily knows best, and confidence in the federal government is at an all-time low. Furthermore, it also appears that Americans understand the virtues of federalism. According to a survey of 2013 polling data, today's Americans believe that state and local governments are best able to handle the following responsibilities by the indicated percentages. Housing by 82% of Americans, transportation 78%, education 75%, and welfare 69%. Those are precisely the kinds of responsibilities that the Constitution has reserved to the states, the kinds that federal agencies have taken over. Whether congressional newcomers embrace my proposal or not, its potential popular support could itself carry the day. If enough Americans learn of the grants program's true costs, they will know they have everything to gain from their termination, both as citizens and taxpayers. As we saw in the response to Newt Gingrich's contract with America in 1994 and the grassroots demand for fiscal responsibility in 2010, an aroused electorate can achieve political miracles. For all these reasons, and because my proposal is based not on ideology but on an objective evaluation of 50 years of experience with federal grants to the states, I believe there is a good chance that it will receive a fair hearing from Republicans and Democrats alike. What is required is that its merits be debated. It is my hope that my book might trigger that debate, and I thank the Federalist Society for giving me this opportunity to initiate it.
Well, it is my great pleasure to be here to comment on this wonderful book. Judge Buckley, Senator Buckley, has, I think, diagnosed the problem well, and it ought not to come as any surprise. The founders understood this very problem. They built into the Constitution a restriction on Congress being able to do what it does. But in the early pages of the book, Senator Buckley says, over the years, successive Congresses and an accommodating Supreme Court have emasculated federalism to the point where there's virtually no exercise of federal power that the court will not deem unconstitutional, largely because of the construction of both commerce and spending powers. And it's that phrase, an accommodating Supreme Court, that I want to focus on a little bit, because I think it's the Supreme Court's abdication of its constitutional duty in this area that has led the political branches to act, unsurprisingly, like political branches, that they pursue their own benefits rather than the common good if given the opportunity. And Senator Buckley's book lays out time and time and time again why those structural incentives in the Congress have produced the mess we're in. Members of Congress has found it very convenient for their re-elections to bring money home to their districts. This is not new. In the first 80 years of our nation's history, a number of presidents vetoed what they called then internal improvements bills for precisely this reason. James Buchanan's veto message of a land grant bill is particularly instructive on the issues that Senator Buckley has raised. The representatives of the states and of the people They said, feeling a more immediate interest in obtaining money to lighten the burdens of their constituents than for the promotion of the more distant objects entrusted to the federal government, will naturally incline to obtain means from the federal government for state purposes. If a question shall arise between an appropriation of land or money to carry into effect the objects of the federal government or those of the states, their feelings will be enlisted in favor of the latter. This is human nature, and hence the necessity of keeping the two governments entirely distinct. Then he goes on to say, besides, it would operate with equal detriment to the best interest of the states themselves. It would remove the most wholesome of all restraints on legislative bodies, that of being obliged to raise money by taxation from their own constituents, and it would lead to extravagance, if not corruption. What is easily obtained and without responsibility will be lavishly expended. And I think that describes well. On Wednesday, as I was heading to the airport to fly here for the convention, we had a new lane opened on our highway. It saved me 3.5 minutes, this carpool lane, at the federal expense of $250 million. And this program has been underway to give us this. We don't have to get out of the carpool lane to take the exit anymore. We can stay in the carpool lane all the way to its own exit. That's its whole purpose. $250 million that I suspect if we were raising it among our local constituents, who will now benefit by that 3.5 minutes collectively, we would have spent that $250 million on something else. This is exactly the problem that Senator Buckley has identified and diagnosed. However, let me address some of the solutions. I think his solutions are wonderful if they were politically possible, and here's where I'm going to raise a pessimistic note, because I'm not sure they are. I wish they were, and I'm not sure they are, but so let me go to those. One of the solutions is to repeal the ability of Congress to spend all this money. But there's a litany of things that makes it, I think, politically impossible to get that through Congress that he outlines in the book. It will deny members of Congress their easiest path to reelection. It will threaten jobs of thousands of federal bureaucrats. Most significantly, it will deprive governors and mayors of easy access to money they don't have to raise from their own taxpayers. And it will distress the hordes of special interests that rely on these programs to impose their goals and priorities over their states and level government. Now, any one of those might be overcome, but collectively, that's a very powerful political force standing in the way of reform. He also proposes some ancillary measures, which I think are worth serious consideration, but again, I think they face a very significant uphill political battle. Term limits, 75% of the people in the country support it. He recognizes, I think quite rightly, that we would never get a serious proposal out of the Congress to restrict their own authority. So we would have to call a constitutional convention, which I support for a lot of reasons, but I'm not sure a lot of people do. Remove campaign contribution caps, because that would eliminate the need for the congressman to continually be running back to the district to get reelected and get raising funds for themselves, and either by deal with the questions of corruption or concerns about corruption by full disclosure, or perhaps even better, a very unique proposal to let major contributions in unlimited amounts be made to candidates that you support because you agree with what they're trying to do through an anonymous third-party source. So if I want to give $1 million to a candidate I support, I give it to the organization that then distributes it out, and they never know who gave it to them. Very interesting. And then most importantly, he says we should overrule a couple of at least 1937 decisions from the Supreme Court that allowed this mess to begin, Steward Machine versus Davis. I would add to that several other cases from that era. But I think this goes back to the opening line that I started with, an accommodating Supreme Court, right? Madison and the rest of the founders that drafted this Constitution understood that political power will intend to increase itself if given the opportunity. The beauty of our system is every institutional branch has within its power the ability to check the excesses of the other branch. What that means is this thing works because it's a three-part stool. If you knock out any one of the parts, it's going to tip over. And when the court has abdicated its job to serve as a check on Congress natural propensity to want to exceed its constitutional authority, it's not a surprise that Congress has continued to exceed that constitutional authority. All of these political checks that Senator Buckley, I think, quite rightly identifies as great ways to solve the problem, therefore I think won't be successful without that institutional check that the court was supposed to provide. So I think what we need is a court that understand its role, that being accommodating is to Congress's exercise of power beyond its constitutional authority is not what the founders had in mind. That the power to spend for the general welfare was a limitation, not a grant on power. That it meant to spend for the welfare that was for the nation, the general, rather than the local or parochial interests of individual states or individual individuals. And until the court starts enforcing that, I fear that all of the wonderful highlighting of the problem and the proposals to solve it that Senator Buckley has proposed won't succeed. So let me close with this. I think Justice O'Connor in dissent in South Dakota versus Dole recognized the problem. When the court deferred to Congress to define the scope of the general welfare, that means we're relying on the politicians who are supposed to be checked by the courts to define how far their power can reach, and not surprisingly, they always seem to think it reaches to infinity and beyond. And she says, if the spending power is to be limited only by Congress's notion of the general welfare, the reality is that the spending clause gives power to the Congress to become a parliament of the whole people, subject to no restrictions such as save or self-imposed. This was not the framers' plan, and it is not the meaning of the spending clause. I compliment Senator Buckley for highlighting this issue and bring it to all of our attentions.
God bless Senator James Buckley. This small book is filled with shrewd observations and very telling and frequently amusing examples of cooperative federal funding, federalism in action. Its big, bold idea is to cash out and then phase out any and all federal transfer programs. I have no idea whether that particular proposal will gain traction, but I share the Senator's sense of urgency, and I'm firmly persuaded that something on that scale in some form is needed. Either we heed this clarion call or we'll be Argentina in no time flat. By consensus among the panelists here, I'm supposed to don my political scientist's hat, and completely out of character, I will sound a note of optimism. Guarded optimism, but, you know, optimism, and the cause of my good cheer is the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act is not a piece of wild-eyed nationalism. It's not a single-payer system. It is the most extreme embodiment of the fake federalism that James Buckley and John Eastman and I myself loathe. And it is crumbling at all ends. Depending on the lessons we learn from that and how we play our cards, it could be a complete game changer and open the door to reforms on the scale contemplated by Senator Buckley. There are six lessons here, I think. I list them in no particular order. First, cooperative federalism programs, funding programs, do not work. Now, at some level, we all understand that. The response to Katrina was a cooperative program. That did not work. Our education system is Katrina in slow motion, has been for five decades. But evidently a natural disaster doesn't teach the obvious lesson, and a creeping one doesn't either. You cannot rely on the Hindenburg. You need Gettysburg. And lo and behold, you know, there it is. There's the ACA, a programmatic initiative that turns into a debacle. A federal government that cannot build a website in 3 years is proposing to run a hugely complicated program with 1,000 moving pieces over decades. Nobody believes that, and nobody will attempt anything like this ever again for quite some time. Second, the ACA marks the limit of fiscal illusions. As Senator Buckley explains, the point of federal funding, federal state funding, is to evade responsibility for inevitable failure, and this is my point here, to obscure the total cost, both at the federal and at the state level. Joint funding makes the programs look much cheaper than in fact they are. An earlier draft of my remarks said that the programs exploit the stupidity of the American voters until somebody stole that line. The ACA's Medicaid expansion, though, it didn't provide partial funding. It promised states 100 cents on the dollar, at least going in the initial years. And at that level, 100 cents on the dollar, funding can no longer do what it's supposed to be doing, which is to drive up state spending and taxes. It's simply cutting checks from a budget that won't sustain it. Third, even at 100 cents for expanding Medicaid, the unthinkable happened. Almost half the states said no, thank you. More dramatically still, two-thirds of all the states said no to federal exchanges and subsidies. Nobody expected this, and frankly, I can't quite explain it. One reason the senator alluded to, I think that the states just don't trust Washington's promises anymore. Total Medicaid costs are now $450 billion. Program grew at 13% last year, or this year. It's supposed to be growing at 7% from here on out, meaning it will at least double in 10 years. Jonathan Gruber is right once again. We are bending the cost curve upward. But the program is ruinous from start to finish, with or without the ACA, and no one thinks that it's financially sustainable. So the game is up. And two, as a percent of state budgets, Medicaid has now eclipsed education spending, and all the programs that aren't federally funded have been cut to the bone. So what that means is that Medicaid and education now compete directly against each other at the state level. And what that means in turn is that state legislatures are trapped between the two most voracious and rapacious lobbies in all of American politics, the NEA and AARP. So cooperative federalism is beginning to eat its young, and not a moment too soon. And the old. Either one of them. Fourth, the state's decision to say no has brought the Constitution back into play. Regardless of what you think about the spending power, it only authorizes Congress to spend and not to commandeer. That matters big time. There would be no Halbig or King litigation without this anti-commandeering rule. Fifth, the ACA has taught the states the power of saying no collectively. As Senator Buckley explains, a single state that says no is just shooting itself in the foot. But 15 or 16 states saying no will bring the entire federal scheme crashing down because the federal government cannot possibly run these programs. HHS is learning that lesson in a real hurry, and so maybe next up the states can teach it to the EPA, whose programs operate on the same principle. A FIP call for 20 states at the same time, that I want to see. Six, political polarization along state lines, sectionalism, as political scientists say, is a good thing. Why were there no grand federal funding programs prior to the New Deal? Answer, there was a constituency against them. The southern states could not be bribed into a federally sponsored tax and spend cartel because there was a non-negotiable issue, race. That's mercifully behind us. What we now have, however, is an increasingly unbridgeable divide, sectional divide over rival social models. There's a firm bloc of states that want a European welfare state. So Illinois and New York and California want more of federal funding, which you need to that end, even though they're net payers. But there's a rival bloc led by Texas, of states led by Texas, that want a more competitive and, if you will, libertarian model, and they can no longer be bribed into federal schemes because they know that those schemes are deadly to their entire business model. Witness the resistance to the ACA. And the beauty of it is that the pro-federal funding states are basket cases, and the dissident states are the most competitive in the country. I like the way this is going. So the federalism that James Buckley describes is bankrupt now, fiscally, morally, politically. As John Eastman suggested, throwing this into reverse is a very tall order, so let me end on a note of caution and note a sort of obstacle that I think would-be reformers have to contend with. Among the most destructive consequences of funding federalism, of these funding programs, is its tendency to foster a social structure resembling that of Tunisia or Argentina. It's not doing much for the poor. If we wanted to help the poor, we would give the money to them and not to state politicians. What it does create, along with this kleptocracy that runs this town, is a vast intergovernmental bureaucracy and a vastly larger industry of consultants and contractors and hangers-on that, while nominally private, is completely parasitic on government. Princeton professor John DiIulio has shown compellingly that to a horrifying extent, this sector has become America's middle class, and the waste and the bloat that's so eloquently described by James Buckley is the lifeblood of that sector and that class. These people will not go gently into that good night. To illustrate how far this has gone and how difficult this will be, in helping the ACA over the hurdle, the health insurance lobby, AHIP, sold the entire industry into government dependency. Unless the mandates stay intact and the subsidies keep flowing, the industry will simply wither away. So if the King plaintiffs win, it won't be 5 minutes before Karen Ignani, AHIP's chief lobbyist here in town, will darken Speaker Boehner's and Senator McConnell's doorstep and beg for a fix, a bailout. When that happens, I want to ask my friend James Buckley to let mercy prevail and to entertain a friendly amendment to his phase-out proposal. One more conditional federal grant, $2,000 to buy Ms. Ignani a one-way ticket to Siberia.
Jim, I want to turn it back over to you for your thoughts on these two things and then turn it over to the audience. I think one note of graciousness by Professor Eastman is he did not quote an interview in the Wall Street Journal over the summer where a particular commenter on your book said that there were very long odds of your reforms being adopted, but he could have certainly cited your own words against you. So if you could start with the practical pessimism and your thoughts on that as you sit here today.
Rob was very kind enough to repeat the specific word that I uttered when I was asked what the odds were against my proposal being swept into effect. I said the odds were 1,000,000 to 1. But I'm an extraordinarily, instinctively extraordinarily conservative in what I say. I think the odds are really closer to 1,000 to 1, which are about the odds that 13 colonies faced when they decided to revolt and seek independence, what was then the strongest military power on Earth, namely Great Britain, which shows that the odds can be beaten. And in any event, there's an old saying somewhere that if the cause is just, hang the odds, plunge ahead. But it occurs to me from what Mr. Eastman said that really what is required is not to try to convince the incoming 27 odd members of Congress to espouse this cause, but all one has to do is to persuade 5 members of the current Supreme Court to understand the incredible unanticipated, these consequences could not have been anticipated back in 1937, and perhaps my book will be an amicus brief in favor of those challenging the case in point. So there's hope there. You don't think that this is a likely one?
No, I don't know. I'm internally optimistic. I wouldn't be fighting these battles otherwise.
But that would be the easiest.
You know, I want to, before we go to the question, I want to take up one thing with the Michael's comment about how ACA has highlighted this. Here's the danger. The striking down the Medicaid expansion that Chief Justice Roberts got a majority to do in the Affordable Care Act, that part of it, misses the real problem. The fact that we were going to remove all of the existing Medicare and Medicaid funding, and that made it unduly coercive, ignores the fact that the real coercion is we're taking money from state taxpayers through Washington and giving it back as grants. So the real race here is going to be not that we have 23 states that haven't set up their state exchanges and watch what happens there. It's whether they will be able to sustain that with their own taxpayers paying money for other states that are in the exchange before the thing collapses. And that's the race that I think is going to be critical. Because after a few years, people are going to grow tired of paying money from their tax base to Washington to pay for massive health care in other states with not a dime of it coming back to themselves. And that's the situation that Chief Justice Roberts' opinion did not touch and pretty clearly indicated that it would not touch. And yet that's the real root of the problem lying into these grants and aid. The real coercion is, I can't say no because I'm still paying for it. The only question is whether I get some of it back or it goes somewhere else. And until we solve that problem, which he has identified and proposed solutions for, this thing is not going to come crashing down. And that's the real big challenge, it seems to me.
Thank you, John. I see we have a number of questions from the audience. Please identify yourself and then pose the question for Senator Buckley or the panel.
Ilya Shapiro from the Cato Institute. I have a semantic question that I think is an entree into a deeper issue, and that is, shouldn't we stop using the phrase cooperative federalism? Because when I think of the federal government getting together with the state government on anything, I worry. I reach for my pocketbook, and I'm very concerned. Not that I'm advocating competitive federalism, it's not that the state should compete with the federal government to do something, but each has its own realm, and essentially rarely should the twain meet. Is that not valid both as an academic framing device and for kind of a larger, whether it be media talking points or conceptions of the role of the different levels of government?
When I use the word federalism, I'm probably using a very primitive, unsophisticated, using it in a very unsophisticated way. What I'm referring to is what I believe in the Constitution's clear allocation of governmental powers as between the federal government and the states. Professor Grieve has written highly sophisticated books on federalism. Perhaps you want to answer that question.
I share your sentiment. My own sort of proposal to get around it is to sort of distinguish between competitive and cartel federalism, because that's what you're looking at. One, you know, cartels at every level is the principle on which we now operate. It's just appalling. I was just using the term here because I didn't want to go into a whole debate about the terminology.
You know, and you know, one of the reasons the Supreme Court correctly identifies federalism is not which government is going to control our lives, but it's to enhance liberty by the two governments playing off each other to make sure neither becomes tyrannical. One of the greatest insights, I think, in this book is, as Senator Buckley goes through the litany of unanticipated costs of these grants and aid programs, the loss of effectiveness, the loss of priorities, the utter waste in money that you spend trying to comply with federal mandates and federal paperwork instead of actually delivering the services that the money is there for, the unfunded mandates, the lawyer's playground of IDEA and special ed and all these things that he identifies. But the greatest of these, and a wonderful insight, is the complete lack of democratic control of political responsibility that flows from not being able to have control of setting the priorities at the local level. We're losing our democratic nature as a result of this addiction to these federal programs. And I think that's a wonderful insight. There's a whole discussion in the book that goes through in great detail how that has come about. And um, I, I,
I that alone is worth the price of admission for this book.
Next questioner.
Ilya Soman, George Mason University. Like Senator Buckley and my colleague Michael Grieve, I've long advocated getting rid of federal grants to state governments, but I'm not super optimistic that we're going to get rid of anything like all of them in the near future. So my question to the panel is, unless and until we get to that happy nirvana where we do get rid of them completely, are there not some intermediate solutions such as limiting their scope, perhaps limiting their subject matter, otherwise constraining them or phasing them out gradually? Because if the choices are either going cold turkey or continuing with the addiction, I think it is much more likely that people would just say, screw it, let's continue the addiction, because cold turkey is just unthinkable.
There's one during the 70s, Congress experimented with what they called, oh my lord, I've reached that stage where I forget words, a revenue sharing. And this involved block grants to the states, no strings attached other than a statement these would be used for this particular purpose. I think that is an intermediate road you can go to, but as happened in the 70s, and it doesn't take long for Congress to start putting its strings back on. So I think it could be no more than a short-term transition period to the kind of fundamental reform that I believe is required.
And one of the things we might consider doing is, you know, when Congress first ventured down this path in the 1930s, they made the grants match programs that the states were funding. And to the extent the state funded it, that reduced the federal tax burden of those state citizens. So getting that tax burden lined up with the program itself would create the right incentives. And that's something that the new class in Congress can start pushing. You know, and they could look at the unconstitutionality of what we've been doing. They can lay some markers, and then for every dollar the states refuse to take in the federal government, their state citizens will pay that percentage reduction in their state taxes, in their federal taxes, and change those incentives. That could be done, and then you'll find a easier cushion transition to the nirvana you've talked about.
Can I just, I hate to say something that makes Ilya Soman look like a moderate and me like the radical, but I'm here to tell you, there are two things that I like about the senator's proposal and why I would resist your suggestion in some ways. The first point is, this must be big. It's too late for incremental reform. And the second thing is that there is this fateful debate on the conservative side that, hey, if we just block grant this, maybe that'll work better. And there are lots of proposals to that end for Medicaid floating around in Washington, and for the reasons that the senator just mentioned, that will never work. So I want to get away from this debate about block grants versus more flexibility versus categorical grant versus No Child Left Behind versus sort of Obamacare for elementary schools or whatever, you know, that they're now cooking up. You have to cash this out. You have got to give the money, if you want to give it, to real life people, not to places, to citizens, not to state bureaucrats. So Medicaid grants are now, I think it's something like $5,500 per recipient. Cash it out, give it to these people, right? That'll end it. I mean, this is not a proposal, I don't think, to sort of just yank $600 billion out of the federal budget because we don't have it. It's to cut the middlemen and these intergovernmental bureaucracies out of the game. And I think if there is a middle road, so to speak, you can do that area by area, right? And there's passages in the book, if I recall correctly, where Senator Buckley endorses sort of swaps. Give entire areas to the federal government alone and, you know, swap that for giving other areas entirely to the states. The Reagan administration tried that. Maybe they just didn't think big enough, and in any event, the circumstances are such now that we're ready to, I think, consider it very seriously, and we ought to.
We have time for one more audience question. Karen Lugo from Texas Public Policy Foundation. In regards to the states just saying no to the Clean Power Plan or the new carbon rule, Judge Kavanaugh, in a recent opinion, a dissent, noted that the EPA had said that, you know, in this case, it was a greenhouse gas case, the states did not complain much. And Judge Kavanaugh responded with something like, they didn't know how bad it would be. In this case, as General Pruitt from Oklahoma, Attorney General, has been saying, this will affect a transfer of the state traditional implementation power for the EPA regulations to the federal government. So we do know in this case how bad it will be. And what might you recommend as far as a way, a mechanism by which states might complain enough this time so that it is a matter of record and that states are saying no?
How about a joint letter, and I'm saying this only half facetiously, a joint letter signed by 20 state attorneys generals, governors, and commissioners of equality, of environmental quality, or whatever they're called in these particular states. Dear federal government, we have come to realize that we are all idiots who are polluting the planet. You are so much better at running these programs than we are. We have therefore concluded we should shut down all our state permitting agencies beginning tomorrow. And now you run those programs, and good luck to you.
And they should include in the letter a good healthy dose of Delta smelt and a number of other ant critters just to make sure they get the message. No, look, Judge Buckley's book speaks largely about the spending clause problem, but he begins by saying this problem arises from the expansive interpretation that has been allowed by the court on both the spending clause and the commerce clause. The two things have to work in tandem. They both had limits, and the court has abdicated its duty on both of those fronts. The EPA question is a regulatory front flowing out of excesses under the commerce power. The rest of these things we've been talking about are the result of abdication by the court on limiting providing the constitutional check on the limits on the spending power. Both has to be addressed, or this federal government is going to act capaciously as every other central government in human history does if you don't have the checks on them. And, you know, we had a double check. We had a check from the court that was supposed to operate internally and a check from the states. And the states need to get a little more backbone, but as we've seen, they have a very powerful incentive not to do that. It's much easier to build a new bridge in your state if you don't have to tax your citizens to pay for it, but you get some other state citizens to pay for it. You get all the credit, and you don't bear any of the costs. Well, this conference we're concluding is about the bill we're about to hand to the next generation. All right, it's not $17 trillion, it's $205 trillion, according to the latest Brookings study, of unfunded liabilities that we have already incurred. They will never pay that off, and it's because we have gotten this basic structural thing wrong, and we got to get it back right if we have any expectation to fix that problem.
Jim, would you like to say anything else?
No, I just couldn't agree more.
Thank you.
Dean's going to close the convention. Before he does, I want to mention that the book will be available electronically starting Monday, shortly thereafter in print. And if you haven't read it, or you haven't read anything by Jim, you really should. Even putting aside the entire matter of the contents of the book or the merits of its proposal, just in the matter of form and style, it is exemplary. It'll make you a better thinker. It'll make you a better writer. It'll make you a better lawyer. So I urge all of you to buy it starting on Monday.
What a terrific session and a great way to end our convention. I want to add my thanks to our panelists, with special thanks to Senator Buckley, and to Rob Gassaway for bringing the idea of this panel to the Federalist Society and then helping to make it happen. I think back to Justice Scalia's opening remarks on Magna Carta on Thursday morning, and this afternoon's session seems to me a perfect bookend. To you, our audience, our members, let me extend our most sincere thanks to all of you for making time this week for our convention and for making it a special experience for all of us. And now, I will hope you'll join us for our closing reception just across the hallway. Thank you very much, everyone.